Ms. Dillon, how much time would you like for rebuttal?
5 minutes, please.
5 minutes?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. May it please the court, I am appointed to represent Wesley Carlton Smith in his case. The primary focus of my argument has to do with the unit of prosecution for the robbery conviction. With regards to that, I believe it's very well established that from this court that there are several things that need to be shown for each robbery. The basic elements include the taking with the intent to steal, the personal property of another from his person or in his presence against his will by violence or intimidation. Furthermore, this court has repeatedly upheld that there is a unit of prosecution that is based, it is determined on the by the number of persons from whose possession property is taken separately by force or intimidation. Even in the case cited by the Commonwealth in its reply brief, the Clay case, that unit of prosecution was still clear. In Clay, there were two victims. They were standing side by side, and both of them were patted down, both of them were held at gunpoint, and the property was clearly established to belong to both of them. One of them had a jacket on that had the money from the other victim. The defendant came up, held both of them at gunpoint, they patted the second victim down, they took the jacket contained the money, and it was held to be a separate robbery for each victim because there was a different element of a taking from each one. So the one lost the money in his presence, the other one lost the jacket in his presence. Both of them were subject to the force by the defendant.
Counsel, I suppose you're referring to the fact that the passenger cell phone is the item that was stolen. Is that part of where you're going with your argument in reference to Clay and why you find it not to be applicable in this case?
That is part of it, but it is not the only thing. Everything that was taken from the passenger side of the vehicle. There is nothing that was clearly established to have belonged to the person who was deceased.
What do we do about the Hello Kitty tape, which arguably is very distinguishable, is part of the tape that was utilized to basically tape on the bumper and was found in the area where the cap is.
Well, there is no
item that has some value to it.
Yes, Your Honor. But there is no indication that that tape belonged to the driver, that the car even belonged to the driver, that he had any possessory interest in any of the things that were actually taken, or that anything was taken from the driver's side. The testimony was that basically it sounds like all four of them talked about committing a robbery. One person apparently only intended to do a murder. Because there was no record of any type of demand for money, no demand for anything. There was nothing
except
where he was told to bring anything
in. We're going to do a lick, which apparently is translated into a robbery. So we do have that in the record.
And I believe that is appropriate for the conspiracy to commit robbery. And I think the Hello Kitty tape goes in for the conspiracy to commit robbery as well.
But not to the individual count of robbery.
Not because he was not, that particular victim was not asked to provide anything. It's not like he handed him the Hello Kitty tape or he was told, give me something, and that's what he gave him. It's not as if anyone went in through the driver's side door or anywhere that
the murder victim was. But it's a reasonable inference that it was taken at that time.
Yes, but not from that victim. There's no possessory interest in it. So if it's not his tape and it wasn't taken from his person, then there is no evidence that
the car that he was driving, though.
The car that he was driving, but that does not make it his vehicle. Both of them were in the vehicle. They did not take the car. They took something that was inside of the car from the passenger side. Now, I would say if he had actually entered, if anyone had entered in through the driver's side while this man was being held at gunpoint before he was actually shot, then there would be more of an inference to be able to make. But in this case, the testimony was that one person went and took money from the person who was being held. Another went in through the passenger side and ransacked the car. On the other side, this person was just killed. I don't know why the jury decided not to convict of murder. I think that there would have been sufficient element. If we were talking about a murder conviction, there would have been sufficient evidence. But we're not. We're talking about a robbery. And in this case, they had to prove that something was taken from him, or that he somehow contributed to that. So, for example, in the other cases, with regards to Lewis, for example, the victim was shot without any demand for money and without taking any direct action towards robbing him.
Lewis is distinguishable, wouldn't you agree, from the instant facts here? Because in Lewis, the decedent is shot immediately without any demand. Here, there's a discussion, allegedly, between the appellant and the decedent, where he's telling him not to do things, telling him, instructing him prior to the killing. Not saying the appellant, obviously he's not convicted of that, but prior to the decedent being shot and killed.
There was testimony that the victim said something along the lines of, all right. I would submit it's not clear. I'm sorry?
He also says, I told you not to do that. That's the alleged statement attributed to the appellant.
I do take issue with whether that was really the appellant or not, considering that he was found not guilty of the murder, that the person who pulled a gun on him was attributed with that statement. The jury found that he was not the person who committed the murder. So I do take some issue with finding that he was the one there.
Could also be considered for part and parcel of the robbery, too, not just the murder.
In terms of what they were saying to everyone, yes, it could. But there was no testimony that he said anything about a demand for money. It sounds more to me, I think, in a reasonable inference, is that that the person who actually killed him went with the intention of killing him. That the group may have thought that they were just doing a robbery or just doing a lick, but that the person who killed him really wasn't in any type of a demand. They were just trying to kill him. And so that murder was completed, but there wasn't any type of a demand for property or any property actually taken. And okay, so similarly in Jordan, where we have the fast food restaurant at Wendy's, it was very clear that the court was clear about the unit of prosecution, and it had to do with each employee being given a separate direction of what they had to do. It's not necessarily every person who happened to be in Wendy's or who was anyone who happened to be around a robbery or that money is taken from that person's presence, around that person's presence. It had to do with whether that particular individual was told, you get this money from here, you get me that money from there, you do this, and they're giving directions and actually taking money from that person. And so that is where you have to have all of the elements for each individual robbery in order to have that unit of prosecution. And as the Commonwealth noted in its brief, in its reply brief, I am not saying that the evidence based on everything that's coming in is insufficient for the robbery of the other victim or for the conspiracy to commit robbery if all of the evidence is considered. But I do believe that, I would submit, that it is not sufficient for showing the actual taking from that victim because you don't have anything specific as required in the other cases, including Lewis and Jordan, and even in one of the cases cited by Clay and Sullivan. In every case that I've seen from this court, the unit of prosecution does require that very specific action for that victim and proof that something was actually taken from that individual. And I would note that the victim in here, Beanham's cell phone, was actually still present at the scene. There's no indication anything was taken from his person. There's no evidence that he was directed to take anything out of the car. No evidence that anything was taken from the driver's side of the car. And so while I think there is a rule in that Hello Kitty tape, that I don't believe that it rises to the level of showing a taking from that individual because it was taken from the other side of the car where the other victim was and is just part of the conspiracy or part of that robbery. If there aren't any additional questions, I will move on to the briefly to the second assignment of error. This issue was very well preserved by the trial counsel. They did have a motion to suppress on it. It did appear that a lot of the testimony was a little different than what the trial counsel had anticipated based on the preliminary hearing. I do have to apologize that the Commonwealth was correct that I did misstate about the obstruction of justice. It was a misdemeanor obstruction of justice and not a felony obstruction of justice, and I apologize for my error in that and stand corrected. In this case, I submit that the issue is really in looking at the totality of the circumstances, the totality of the pressure that was put on this individual and his inability to actually observe the witnesses on the other side of the car before making an identification. I do have to concede that while the very specific setup of having the photo lineup in the folders, in the 10 folders, is not necessarily abnormal. So I don't really have a clear smoking gun with regards to that. That basically what we are looking at is the totality of the circumstances, looking at all of the factors.
The court made the decision that the lineup was not unduly suggestive, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so we really don't get to the second part of the reliability. You're talking more about the Biggers factors.
Yes, Your Honor. With regards to the court's ruling that it was not unduly suggestive, I would ask the court to consider looking at all of the factors and determining whether or not it makes sense that there couldn't have been something suggestive about the lineup. But yes, I will concede that there is not anything very clearly in the record saying that the lineup was unduly suggestive.
Counsel, you're into your rebuttal time.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Campbell.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Aaron Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth. I'll just begin with the robbery, since that's where opposing counsel began. And I think it's important to take in consideration that the taking of personal property from someone's person or presence is broadly construed. That's what the case law says. So you have a case like Price, where the victim was in her bedroom. I think it was a knife or gun to her, and her purse was stolen in another part of her house. So it doesn't have to be right on this person's person, per se, in order for there to be a taking to constitute robbery.
So the car is comparable to the house. If you take something out of the car and the guy is driving the car and has the car in his possession, that if you take something from the car, it's from his person.
Exactly.
And that, for purposes of the robbery.
For purpose of the robbery. I mean, if he had not had the gun to his head, he could have prevented a taking of something that was in his possession. He was driving this car. It would stand the reason that the items that are in the car are under his constructive possession.
What about counsel's argument that it's not his car, or that there's no evidence that it's his car?
I don't think that really makes a difference at all, because he is driving the car, and that just because it's not his car, he still is in constructive possession and responsible for whatever is in that car. I would say there are at least two items, I think, that are important here. And before I say that, let me also say that their case law says there can actually be two victims having possession of one item, so long as they both have constructive possession of that item. So that's why we made our argument on brief that one of the items that we know was taken from the car was Mr. White's cell phone. And we know that it was in the car. That was his testimony. My cell phone was in the car.
So are you suggesting, though, counsel, that by virtue of the fact that his White's cell phone is taken, that would be the robbery that would be effective for Mr. Beeman?
Yes, because it was in the car. It wasn't on Mr. White's person. It was in a car that Mr. Beeman had possession of. If had not had the gun to his head, he could have prevented the taking of that cell phone that was in the car. Or the other item, as we've already talked about, is the Hello Kitty duct tape. I never thought that Hello Kitty duct tape would be play such an important role, but here we are. Duct tape was found amidst the fruits of the robbery. That was found by the police with the license plate, the guns, the cell phone, the knit cap that was the defendant's knit cap that had his DNA in it. I think he actually testified that was my knit cap. All those things were found in the fridge amongst the fruits of the robbery, and as we know from the evidence, is that this distinctive duct tape was matched the duct tape that was on the back of the bumper of the victim's car. And therefore, a reasonable fact finder could reasonably infer that this was amongst the items that were taken. It doesn't have to be an expensive item. It just has to be, you know, an item that was taken during the midst of the robbery, and a reasonable fact finder could make that conclusion. If there are no questions about the robbery, I will move on to the photo lineup. Okay. The defendant has a weighty burden. There's a two-part test, and first, the defendant has to prove that the photo lineup was unduly suggestive, and then if you prove that it's unduly suggestive, then you have to prove that it was necessarily unreliable. The trial court made a finding that this was not unduly suggestive, therefore not even reaching the second part of it. The way I understand the appellant's argument is that because Mr. White had this pending charge, then he felt pressure to make this identification. That is not bore out by the record when you view it in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth. I mean, Mr. White testified that he did not feel any obligation to make an identification to have his obstruction of justice charge dismissed, and that's on appendix page 148. The trial court made a factual finding that he accepted Mr. White's testimony that he did not feel the pressure to make an identification. But even then, I don't, that's not the actual legal test that we're concerned about when there's an unduly suggestive photograph. The test is that, did the police do something to make the witness believe that this was the person that the police were suspecting? And that's not what we have here whatsoever. Anytime somebody would be under pending charges, the way I understand the appellant's argument is that you would have to say that's somehow unduly suggestive, but that's not, would not be a good rule, nor is it the rule that that we're concerned about here. The sin that we're trying to avoid is the police suggesting identification, and there's nothing, as counsel conceded this morning, about the photo lineup itself that was suggestive in any way. Therefore, the trial court did not err in ruling that this photo lineup was not unduly suggestive. Unless the court has questions, I'd ask that the court affirm.
Thank you. Ms. Dillon, you've got a little over 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. In response to the Commonwealth's argument regarding Price, I believe that is distinguishable, or would submit that is distinguishable from this case, and that it was clearly established that the items in a different portion of the house were, in fact, her items. Similarly, with regards to the case in Clay, I submit that the way that the court issued its decision and wrote its decision, that the only reason that there were two robberies appropriate instead of one was because there was clearly a separate evidence for each robbery conviction. In that case, if the $20 belonged to the first victim instead of to the second victim, there would not have been a robbery of the second victim because there would not have been a taking from that person. That person did not have anything on him. There would not have been a taking there. It was a taking because he was in the presence, he was standing arm to arm with the other victim, he'd been subject to the pat down, he'd been held at gunpoint, and the money was actually his. But if the money had not been his, it would not have been a robbery. Some other crimes may have been appropriate, but it would not have been a robbery because not all of the elements would have been there. And similarly, if the $20 did belong to him and he had not been present at the time, it would not have been a robbery. It would have been a petty theft because that would have been a taking of his money, even though he wasn't aware and he wasn't present at the time, but there wouldn't have been the force or violence or anything like that to sustain that conviction. All of the elements must be there for each victim in order to sustain a conviction for the robbery for each victim. And in this case, the evidence only showed the murder of Mr. Beanham. It did not show a robbery of him, but the jury acquitted him of murder. So, and none of those facts can be used in saying that, well, I guess a robbery is close enough. That's not the way it works. You need all of the elements. Robbery is not a lesser included of murder. So unless there are any additional questions, I would ask the court to grant the petition, at least with regards to the second assignment of error, to reverse his conviction for the robbery of Mr. Beanham. And if the court finds under the totality of circumstances that there was some unduly suggestive issue with regards to arrest, to remand for that. Thank you very much.